Happy Halloween!
Happy Halloween!
The moment is here.
Long.
It's our moment to shine.
Yes.
So, our treat for you today is we are going to talk about War of the Worlds.
Yep.
And we're not talking about today, like what's happening in the real world. We're going to take you back to October 30th, 1938. So as the clock struck 8 p.m. in New York City on the night of October 30th, 1938, Orson Welles stood on a podium inside a Madison Avenue radio studio, and he decided to scare the shit out of the world. Did you like that intro?
I did. I loved it.
So if you are not familiar with the War of the Worlds, we're about to explain it to you. So the War of the Worlds begins with a paraphrase of the beginning of the novel updated to contemporary times. We know now that in the early years of the 20th century, this world was being watched closely by intelligences greater than man's and yet as mortal as his own. We know now that as human beings busied themselves about their various concerns, they were scrutinized and studied, perhaps almost as narrowly as a man with a microscope might be scrutinized the transient creatures that swarm and multiply in a drop of water. With infinite complacence, people went to and fro over the earth about their little affairs, serene in the assurance of their dominion over the small, spinning fragment of solar driftwood, which by chance or design, man has inherited out of the dark mystery of time and space. Yet across an immense ethereal gulf, minds that are too, or minds as ours, are to the beasts in the jungle, intellects vast, cool, and unsympathetic, regarded this earth with envious eyes and slowly and surely drew their plans against us. In the 39th year of the 20th century came the great disillusionment. It was near the end of October. Business was better. The war scare was over. More men were back at work. Sales were picking up. And on this particular evening, October 30th, the Crossley service estimated that 32 million people were listening in on the radios. And that was the beginning of the War of the Worlds radio broadcast. So a bunch of families were sitting around the radio, and it's kind of funny because like now in 2020, like 100 years later, I mean, this is the 30s, but you know, almost 100 years later when we have all these technologies, now we have podcasts. So people are listening to their podcasts, and maybe we're not gathering together as families, but we have our earbuds in, and it's like we still want to listen to these stories. And people thought they were tuning in to listen to, you know, music or the news, and they decided that they were gonna scare the crap out of everybody because Halloween was coming up, and it was really, really controversial. And there were people that were like, this is a bad idea, you shouldn't do it, you shouldn't do this. And Orson Welles had some actors like kind of sitting out, and they're like, no, we got to do this, it's gonna be awesome. And there was some fallout, which you're going to talk about, but I did want to just kind of go into the plot summary first. So their radio program begins as a simulation of a normal evening radio broadcast featuring a weather report and music by Ramon Riccello and his orchestra live from a local hotel ballroom. And I believe that they originally were going to use like a real hotel name, and like the person that was like, guys, we shouldn't do this. They finally said, okay, fine, we won't use a real hotel name. So I think they were like, okay, fine. So I can just imagine this like one guy in the corner like, come on guys, this isn't cool, we're gonna get sued. Like, please. Like, we're gonna get in so much trouble. And they're like, if you just shut up, we won't use a real hotel name.
Okay.
So after a few minutes, the music begins to be interrupted by several news flashes about strange gas explosions on Mars. And then an interview is arranged with a reporter, Carl Phillips, and Princeton-based professor of astronomy, Richard Pearson, who dismisses speculation about life on Mars. The musical program returns temporarily, but is interrupted again by news of strange meteorite landing in Grover's Mill, New Jersey. Phillips and Pearson are dispatched to the site where a large crowd has gathered. Phillips describes the chaotic atmosphere around the strange cylindrical object, and Pearson admits that he does not know exactly what it is, but that it seems to be made of an extraterrestrial metal. The cylinder unscrews, and Phillips describes the tentacled, horrific monster that emerges from inside. Police officers approach the Martian, waving a flag of truce, but the invaders respond by firing a heat ray, which incinerates the delegation and ignites the nearby woods and cars as the crowd screams. Phillips shouts about incoming flames are cut off mid-sentence, and after a moment of dead air, an announcer explains that the remote broadcast was interrupted due to some difficulty with our field transmission. After a brief piano interlude, regular programming breaks down as the studio struggles with casualty and firefighting updates. A shaken Pearson speculates about Martian technology. The New Jersey State Militia declares martial law and attacks the cylinder. So I can just imagine, like, if you're listening to this, like, okay, kids, you're gonna listen to some music. It's like, yeah, I mean, I can imagine being like pissed too, like. And they did say that they had a lot of like, you know, what you're about to hear is like pretend or fake, and that they had a lot of disclaimers, but a lot of people claim that they never heard any of like these disclaimers.
So I took like a film class not this past spring, but the spring before that, and we actually talked about this and Orson Welles, and if I remember correctly, they actually said the first time they broadcast it, there were no warnings.
Yeah, that's interesting.
So, and that's why some of the fallout was so bad.
Yeah. So a captain from their field headquarters lectures about the overwhelming force of properly equipped infantry and the helplessness of the Martians until a tripod rises from the pit. The tripod obliterates the militia and the studio returns, now describing that the Martians as an invading army. Emergency response bulletins give way to damage and evacuation reports as thousands of refugees clog the highways. Three Martian tripods from the cylinder destroy power stations and uproot bridges and railroads, reinforced by three others from a second cylinder that landed in the Great Swamp near Morristown as gas explosions continue. The Secretary of the Interior addresses the nation. So, I mean, like, if you didn't, whether there were warnings and you didn't hear them, or you tune in late, or whatever the reason, if they're like, the Secretary of the Interior is now addressing the nation.
Right.
Like, what the fuck, right? So right. Then a live connection is established to a field artillery. And this is like the radio. So it's not like you're watching the news and you're like, wait, that's not the Secretary of Interior. Like, you know, what is like, what's his face? The guy that always plays the president, Morgan Freeman. It's not like Morgan Freeman is on the TV and you're like, he's not the Secretary of Interior. Like, you know, and you know that is like an act, like a pretend thing or some Facebook live video or something. So a live connection is established to a field artillery battery in the Watchung Mountains. Its gun crew damages a machine, resulting in a release of poisonous black smoke before fading into the sound of coughing. the lead plane of a wing of bombers from Langham Field broadcasts its approach and remains on the air as their engines are burned by a heat ray and the plane dives on the invaders in a last-ditch suicide attack. Radio operators go active and fall silent. Although the bombers manage to destroy one machine, the remaining five are spreading black smoke across the Jersey marshes into Newark. Eventually, a news reporter broadcasting from atop the broadcasting building describes the Martian invasion in New York City, five great machines wading the Hudson, like men wading through a brook. Black smoke drifting over the city, people diving into the East River like rats, others in Times Square falling like flies, he reads a final bulletin, stating that Martian cylinders have fallen all over the country, then describes the smoke approaching down the street until he suffocates and kneels over, leaving only the sound of the city under attack in the background. Finally, a despairing ham radio operator is heard calling, 2X2L, calling CQ, New York, isn't there anyone on the air? Isn't there anyone on the air? Isn't there anyone? After a period of silence comes the voice of announcer Dan Seymour. You are listening to a CBS presentation of Orson Welles and the Mercury Theater on the air in an original dramatization of the War of the Worlds by H.G. Wells. The performance will continue after a brief intermission. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System. The last third of the program is a monologue and dialogue. Professor Pearson, having survived the attack of Grover's Mill, attempts to make contact with other humans in Newark. He encounters an opportunistic militiaman who holds fascist ideals in regards to man's relationship with the Martians and intends to use Martian weaponry to take control of both species, declaring that he wants no part of his world. Pearson leaves the stranger with his delusions. His journey takes him to the ruins of New York, where he discovers that the Martians have died. As with the novel, they fell victim to earthly pathogenic germs, to which they had no immunity. Life eventually returns to normal, and Pearson finishes writing recollections of the invasion and its aftermath. After the conclusion of the play, Wells reassumed his role as host and told listeners that the broadcast was a Halloween concoction, the equivalent, as he put it, of dressing up in a sheet, jumping out of a bush, and saying boo. Popular mythology holds that the disclaimer was hastily added to the broadcast at the insistence of CBS executives as they became aware of panic inspired by the program. In fact, at station break, network executive Davidson Taylor had attempted to prevent Wells, who had added the speech at the last minute, from reading it on air for fear of exposing the network to legal liability, but Wells delivered it anyway. So you have some more information about the fallout, I believe, because I could imagine, like, if I'm sitting there with my family and I hear this happening, like, I don't believe they had Costco in 1938. I strongly believe they did not have Costco in 1938, but, you know, I'm kind of like, I got to get my toilet paper. I got to get my Clorox wipes. I got to get my canned food. So I'm probably turning off the radio halfway through and, like, getting all the things I need, right? And so if they did, like, add this, knowing what we know now about 2020, if they did add the things that they added halfway through, probably wasn't listening anymore.
Yeah.
Right. So, I guess before we do the fallout, I was going to play just a few minutes, if this comes through okay, and I know that you were going to probably add maybe a little bit more, but here's just kind of what that sounded like on that night.
Where are you, 8X3R? What's the matter? Where are you?
Broadcasting building. I'm speaking from the roof of Broadcasting Building, New York City. The bells you hear are ringing to warn the people to evacuate the city as Martians approach. Estimated in the last 2 hours, 3 million people have moved out along the roads to the north. Hutchison River Parkway still kept open for motor traffic. Coyed bridges to Long Island, hopelessly jammed. All communication with Jersey Shore closed 10 minutes ago. No more defenses. Our army is wiped out. Artillery, Air Force, everything wiped out. This may be the last broadcast. We'll stay here to the end.
So that's just a clip of what, you know, you're listening again for weather report, some music, and that's what you get. And yeah. Honestly, if I were listening to the radio right now in the year 2020, I don't know how surprised I would be if that was truly happening. You know, yesterday, right. I didn't actually get to watch the news because it was a pretty busy day, but just seeing news clips of Paris, people trying to leave Paris yesterday. I don't know how much of the news you got to watch, but hearing that and then seeing what's happening. So Paris is about to go on lockdown or is on lockdown. So people, and again, I said I didn't get to watch the news. It was such a busy day yesterday. And so they're about to go on lockdown to quarantine. And so because of that, people are trying to get out of the city because they won't be able to get out of the city. And so there were like hundreds of miles of backups just to get out of the city yesterday.
Oh, wow. Oh, man.
So I feel like hearing that, I'm kind of like, I mean, we're not being invaded by Martians or anything. But it's kind of sad to hear about, you know, like people evacuating or trying to get out of the city. And almost 100 years later, that's not almost too far from the truth of what's happening right now.
Yeah. Oh, man, that's insane.
It's really sad. But yeah. Let's get back to...
Back to War of the Worlds. All right. So, like you said, there was definitely some, like, fallout because there was a panic created by the radio broadcast. So, this article is going to go into, like, kind of the panic that happened. And I got it from history.com. So, as the clock struck 8 p.m. in New York City on the night of October 30th, 1938, Orson Welles stood on a podium inside a Madison Avenue radio studio. This is not deja vu. This is the intro that you all...
Yeah.
For the Columbia Broadcasting System's weekly Mercury Theater on the Air program. Millions of Americans, as they were every night, huddled around their radios, but relatively few of them were listening to CBS when it was announced that Welles and his fellow cast members were presenting an original dramatization of the 1898 H.G. Wells science fiction novel, The War of the Worlds. Instead, most of the country was tuned into NBC's popular Chase and Sanborn Hour, which featured ventriloquist Edgar Bergen and his dummy Charlie McCarthy. Channel surfing, however, was not a modern-day invention, and disoriented listeners who stumbled onto the Mercury Theater on the air without having heard the disclaimer at the top of the radio play were thrust into the middle of an hour-long drama that left some believing the country was under attack. The CBS program, penned by Casablanca writer Howard Koch, opened serenely with the dulcet dance music of Roman Rocello and his orchestra. And then an actor portraying an announcer broke in with a fake news report that several explosions of incandescent gas had occurred on Mars. In quick succession came a series of increasingly alarming suspense-building news flashes that culminated with Martian spacecrafts crashing into farms all over Grover's Mills, New Jersey. In the rest of the hour, For the rest of the hour, Terrell...
Have you been taken over?
I can't. I still can't. detailed an extraterrestrial army of squid-like figures that killed thousands of Earthlings with heat rays and black clouds of poison gas as they steamrolled into New York City. Wells and the rest of the cast impersonated astronomers, state militia officials, I think that's supposed to say military officials, and even the Secretary of the Interior, who cannily sounded like President Franklin D. Roosevelt. Human germs rather than human armies ultimately did in the mythical Martian invaders, and at the end of the hour, the director wrapped up the radio drama by telling his audience, "This is Orson Welles, ladies and gentlemen, out of character to assure you that War of the Worlds has no further significance than as the holiday offering it was intended to be. The Mercury Theater's own radio version of dressing up in a sheet and jumping out of a bush saying, boo." The fright that Welles put into America, however, was much greater than he thought. Although the program included a reminder at intermission that it was a dramatization, thousands of anxious and confused listeners believed it to be real. They besieged police departments, newspapers, and CBS with phone calls. In New Jersey, ground zero for the fictitious invasion, National Guardsmen wanted to know where they should report for duty, and Trenton Police Department fielded 2,000 calls in under 2 hours. In Providence, Rhode Island, hysterical callers begged the electric company to cut power to the city to keep it safe from the extraterrestrial invaders. Fear and anxiety had become a way of life in the 1930s, and it took little to rattle jittery Americans. The Depression had emptied their wallets, and the gathering crisis in Europe threatened to ignite into war. And just weeks earlier, the hurricane of 1938 had roared ashore. Plus, the Hindenburg disaster, which had been broadcast over the airwaves just the year before, was still fresh in the country's collective psyche. The newspaper industry also felt unease from the increasing popularity of radios as an informational and advertising medium, and seeing a chance to strike back at its growing rival, it gleefully collected the sporadic reports of individual confusion generated by War of the Worlds and weaved them into a narrative of mass hysteria. Newspapers reported suicide attempts, heart attacks, and exoduses from major metropolitan areas. The New York Daily News printed the feverish headline, "Fake Radio War Stirs Terror Throughout the U.S. I wonder why terror is a word I'm struggling with today.
No idea.
Along with the photograph of a war victim, a woman in a sling who had heard the reports of black gas clouds in Times Square and ran out from her Midtown apartment into the street where she fell and broke her arm. Similar stories of woe were printed from coast to coast and unleashed a media frenzy. With the threats of lawsuits swirling in the press, CBS went into damage control. As a hastily called press conference, a doe-eyed Welles displayed his theatrical acumen and expressed his remorse and shock at the public reaction. "I can't imagine an invasion from Mars would find ready acceptance," he said when asked if he pranked the country. Decades later, however, Welles admitted, "The kind of response was merely anticipated by us all. The size of it, of course, was flabbergasting." The FCC did not sanction CBS or Welles, and the radio drama. Soup as a sponsor, and soon after, Welles inked a deal to direct Citizen Kane, named by the American Film Institute as the greatest movie of all time. Interesting.
Yeah.
I've seen Citizen Kane, P.S. BTW. I had to watch it for school. Orson Welles was an interesting character. I mean, we had to learn about him, and like, he was just full of it, man.
I can't say that I know a lot about him or anything about him.
I want to say, if I remember correctly, and I could be completely off, but he like ran away from home at 15 and like went to like Europe. And he like and then he's like, "Yo, deuces, I'm leaving." And he went back to America. And he kind of like, he did his own thing. And he didn't really give any fucks, man. He just did what he wanted to do.
Yeah, you do you, boo.
You do you, boo. But, yeah, I mean, I feel like, we're not too far off from this, like, with the panic and everything from the media, except for it's, like, real life, or is it? Because there are people who question how real everything is. Is it fake news? Is it real news?
I know. I kind of wish we weren't living in a reality of fake news or real news. Because, like, it would be kind of fun to have, like, I mean, he pulled off the ultimate prank.
Yeah.
And I wish, like, if we weren't living in such a fragile state at the moment, like, I would have really appreciated such an awesome Halloween prank right now. Things are so, like, fragile and unstable right now. Like, this would not have been cool.
Oh my gosh. I can't even imagine how bad something like this would be at this, like, moment.
It would not be stable. Like, I don't know about, like, your grocery stores. Not that we live that far away from each other at the moment. But toilet paper is gone again.
I will say I went to Costco yesterday and they have toilet paper.
They did? Okay, because that made me nervous again. I was starting to feel good about the grocery, our supply and demand and the chain. And, you know, I was starting to be like, maybe we should stock up again for winter because we're supposed to have a snowy winter. And for us, like, for where we live, a snowy winter isn't like, it could snow 3 times here and that's a snowy winter and, like, we shut down. Yeah. So, and they're actually saying that we're supposed to get, like, a really snowy winter here, like 10 times worse than what it's been.
And we're
kind of, so I can only imagine it being dull. So, I'm like, you know, we should probably just prepare anyway for this snowy winter and for COVID and for
the election,
probably the massive earthquake, and for everything,
the unrest of the upcoming election,
for Yellowstone to explode and the election and, like, aliens and asteroids and
I mean, maybe that's just
dinosaurs.
At least I'll have my Charmin
or anything. I like, too, when I went, like, the other day to Costco, it was, like, all the toilet paper was gone, all the paper towels were gone, like, everything was gone, and there was, like, one package of the organic toilet paper, and I was, like, so, the toilet paper, people probably were, like, I'll use paper towels.
Yeah.
I'll use Kleenex. I'm not using the organic bark to wipe my butt. I've only used paper towels. So enough about toilet paper.
I know, right?
So you have an alien story?
I do have an alien story. It's not very long, but I mean this episode. It's called Aliens Down Under, Australia's top 5 spookiest UFO sightings ever. So this is Frederick Valentik, and he was the pilot that vanished. Okay, so in 1978, a 20-year-old pilot and UFO enthusiast named Frederick Valentik was flying over the Bass Strait separating Tasmania and mainland Australia when he radioed air traffic control in Melbourne. In the transmission, the young man described an object hovering 300 meters, about 1,000 feet above him, and said it was not an aircraft. He made statements like, it has a green light and a sort of metallic light on the outside, and it's coming for me right now. Before his signal was lost, his plane disappeared without a trace, and the mystery intensifies. So that is the missing pilot of Frederick Valentik.
Wow, that's like
like super underwhelming. It is. It is creepy, but I mean, give me more.
Well, I think that's what makes it creepy is that there isn't more. You know, it's like there's that's this true. Silver thing with a green light, and it's coming at me, and then boom, that's it. Nothing more.
Yeah.
And Australia has a lot of alien stories. It's really weird. Because, like, when it comes to America, it's always, like, middle America.
Yeah.
In and it's kind of like, yeah, what's up with, like, middle America? And it always just seemed to be middle America. And then when you kind of, like, start looking, it's, like, middle America and then Australia.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I want to go to Australia.
Mm-hmm. I think...
Even if it means I'm go.
And really big spiders. They have some, like, freaky animals down there.
So I did actually find the transcript for this Fresh Atlantic's thing.
Okay.
Okay. So it's between the Atlantic pilot and then a guy named Roby. Mm-hmm. So Atlantic says, is there any known traffic below 5,000 feet? No known traffic. Seems to be a large aircraft below 5,000. What type of aircraft is it? I cannot affirm. It is four bright. It seems to me like landing lights. The aircraft has just passed over me at least 1,000 feet above. Roger. And it is a large aircraft, confirm. Unknown. Due to the speed it's traveling, is there any Air Force aircraft in the vicinity? No known aircraft in the vicinity. It's approaching right now from due east towards me. Silence for 2 seconds. It seems to me that he's playing some sort of a game. He's flying over me 2-3 times at a time at speeds I couldn't identify. Roger, what's your actual level? My level is 4,500, 4,500. And confirm you cannot identify the aircraft? Affirmative. Roger, stand by. It's not an aircraft. It's a... Silence for 2 seconds. Can you describe the aircraft? As it's flying past, it's a long shape. Silence for 3 seconds. Cannot identify more than that it has such speed. Silence for 3 seconds. It is before me right now, Melbourne. And how large would the object be? It seems like it's stationary. What I'm doing right now is orbiting, and the thing is just orbiting on top of me also. It's got a green light and a sort of metallic light. It's all shiny on the outside. Silence for 5 seconds. It's just vanished. Would you know what kind of aircraft I've got? Is it military aircraft? Confirm. The aircraft just vanished. Say again. Is the aircraft still with you? It's a silence for 2 seconds. Now approaching from the southwest, the engine is rough idling. I've got it set at 23, 24, and the thing is coughing. Roger, what are your intentions? My intentions are to go to King Island. Melbourne, the strange aircraft is hovering on top of me again. Silence for 2 seconds. It's hovering and it's not an aircraft. Silence for 17 seconds. Open microphone with audible, unidentified staccato noise. End of transcript. Dang. I feel like I wanted... Okay, so in the first thing I read, like, that just kind of gave me a tidbit, but this is what I wanted. Like, give me, like, the actual transcript. Mm-hmm. Even though I did a shitty job at reading it, like, it really, like, it builds, like, to that fear of, like, what is he seeing? Like, what's happening?
I know. And they never found the plane either? Or did they find the plane?
I don't think they found the plane. I know there's something about his airplane is missing as well. while he was radioing a UFO report prompted talk of extraterrestrials and abduction. Indeed, it spawned later reports of other UFOs allegedly seen on the night of the Cessna's disappearance. These provoked a skeptical Ken Williams, spokesman of the Department of Transport, to tell a reporter, "It's funny all these people ringing up with UFO reports after the Valentik disappearance." Just a month after the disappearance, the pilot of another Cessna sighted the outline of what he believed was a submerged aircraft out on another passover. He was unable to confirm that observation. And now, thanks to yeoman's work by Australian researcher Keith Basterfield, who rediscovered the lost official case, while we have new information, as he explains, parts of aircraft wreckage with potential matching serial numbers were found in Bass Strait 5 years after the disappearance. Fred Valantik's UFO has now been identified. That is, we can show that a group of four bright lights consistent with the description was within his sight at the time he was reporting the UFO. This was the long missing piece of the puzzle that awaited solving, because the case required expertise from astronomy as well as aeronautics. The identification underscores the inescapable fact that the disappearance was simply a fatal crash. Ironically, it might never have occurred, but for the young pilot's fascination with UFOs, if not actually the reason for his evening flight, as we suspect, the fascination nevertheless was part of why it ended tragically. We can now reread the transcript of the exchanges between Valantik and the air traffic controller with a new understanding in our mind's eye, which we watch in horror as distracted and disoriented, the young pilot unexpectedly enters the graveyard spiral that he carries with him in death. Well, that was sad.
Yeah.
I mean, okay, but like, say he was still abducted by aliens and they just like put his plane back. Or like they just him.
Well, that's an interesting theory right there. I can't say I agree with it, though.
Who knows? I feel like my bubble's been popped, though, after reading that.
I know. You should have just stopped.
Maybe I'll just edit this out.
All right. Well, we hope you enjoyed this episode of Trick or Treat, Why Are You So Scared? It's been a fun-filled Halloween holiday season of having a special episode every day, and we hope that you have a happy Halloween today.
A safe Halloween,
no matter how it is that you're celebrating Halloween, that you have fun, stay safe, and
eat that candy, boo. It's not going to hurt at this point. Just do it.
But just wash your hands and stay safe. And we'll talk at you next time. Bye.
Bye.